Welcome, everybody, to the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello again, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho, broadcasting from BBS Radio 1. And welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. And remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Our very special guest today is legendary British film director, editor, writer, producer, and author Tony Palmer. Tony Palmer's film resume includes over 100 films ranging from early works with the Beatles, Cream, Jimi Hendrix, Rory Gallagher, and Frank Zappa, to his classical portraits, which include profiles of Maria Callas, Margot Fonteyn, John Osborne, Igor Stravinsky, Richard Wagner, Benjamin Britten, and Ralph Vaughan Williams. He is also a stage director of theater and opera. Palmer's latest project is a legendary musical tribute, The Beatles and World War II, issued on CD and DVD by Gonzo Multimedia UK. Take a group of some of the most famous solo artists of the 70s, like Elton John, Tina Turner, The Four Seasons, The Bee Gees, Peter Gabriel, Brian Ferry, Rod Stewart, Leo Sayer, Keith Moon, Helen Reddy, Jeff Lynne, and Frankie Valli, and get them to sing cover versions of some of the most famous Beatles songs ever written. Add a considerable dollop of authentic documentary footage of the Second World War telling the story of that epic encounter. The Beatles and World War II. Sound crazy? It is. But enormously entertaining and occasionally very chilling, a unique blend of music and film like no other. Of that much, we can be absolutely certain. The best collection of Beatles covers in a film ever. In an article written by Ronnie Danilin, editor of Ear Candy magazine, the old 1976 film was the strangest mix of cinema and rock and roll, combining World War II images, including newsreels and Hollywood films made at the time, with the music of the Beatles. Not the Beatles' original recordings, but by various artists. The old movie combined a pastiche of World War II theme film segments, both periods, films and post-war action films, with the backdrop of the music of the Beatles. Strange concept, huh? Well, a long story, but the end result was disastrous. The original distributor junked the film so completely that no copy survived, and the film took on its iconic status. Says legendary director Tony Palmer of his new film, although the original 1976 film had disappeared thanks to the indifference and stupidity of the original distributor, instinctively I felt the central idea and the material and, of course, the music were just too good to be lost forever. So for those fans who have had to rely on a few very poor quality extracts on YouTube, the 2016 film is a completely new experience. And much of it is in HD. Yes, we have used some of the original tracks, but added a lot of new archive footage and some never seen before. In addition, I have often used totally different music. The film starts with Vaughan Williams and ends with Shostakovich taking in Rachmaninoff en route and including many of the famous Second World War speeches by Roosevelt, Churchill, Montgomery, Chamberlain, Joe Kennedy, and Hitler. And the film makes reference to war-torn Syria and the massive problems of immigration along the way. It is a far more complex film than the original, and I hope will give everyone pause for thought about the troubled world in which we live. Directed and edited by Tony Palmer. Please welcome legendary British film director Tony Palmer to the Ray Shasho Show. Hello, Tony.
Hi, Ray. Well, I mean, you've said it, you've practically said it all. I'm not quite sure what I can add. Anyway, I'm sure your listeners would be intrigued to know that I'm halfway up a mountain in Switzerland. I'm about 5,000 or 6,000 feet up and completely in a tiny little isolated village. And the thought that I'm speaking to you across the world is enormously exciting for me, especially on your show.
Well, it's amazing. I guess they have. There must be a. We're not talking on a cell, are we? Are we talking on a cell? Are you on a cell phone?
Well, I mean, we're sending smoke signals from halfway up the mountain, which I assume you're reading.
So, what are you doing on this mountain? Is this a mountain to climb, or is it a
every mountain is to climb. But I have a little farmhouse up here, and I come up here to get away from things from time to time. But it's always a pleasure talking to you. So, I mean, that's the excuse to get back connected to the real world.
Well, that's exciting.
Your description of the film was so spot on. I really had very little to do with the original film.
Right.
I was asked to get involved because the original producers, I mean, we're speaking way back, 1973-74, it was their idea to use Beatle covers with Second World War footage. That was not my idea. But they were worried that Lennon or McCartney might object. I mean, not from a copyright point of view, but, you know, they didn't want their music used in a kind of unsympathetic way. So I was dispatched because I knew them. My job was simply to go and see them, hold their hand and say, this is what they're proposing to do. I think it'll be all right. And all McCartney said to me was, are you involved? And I'm afraid I told a bit of a fib. And I said, well, yes. And he said immediately, well, if you're involved, we're okay. We trust you, and you're a safe pair of hands as far as we're concerned. And all Lennon said was, well, I hope they're going to use Give Peace a Chance. Well, I said, of course. But in fact, they didn't use him, Give Peace a Chance. But that was my job.
Yep.
And then the two producers said, well, you know, would you like to edit all this material that we're collecting? So I said, well, fine. I mean, it does sound very interesting. But unfortunately, at exactly the same time, I'd been trying for years, a few years anyway, to get a big series called All You Need Is Love,
mm-hmm.
a sort of history of American popular music off the ground. But it was huge in scope. That was also Lennon's idea, interestingly enough. And suddenly, I got the money. So I thought, I can't miss that opportunity. So I had to sort of wave bye-bye to the original film. And then, as you quite rightly say, I mean, somebody else edited the material together. I didn't ever see it until quite recently. But 20th Century Fox, who'd commissioned it and paid for it, they didn't understand a word of it. It's not for me to say whether the film was good, bad, or indifferent. But I mean, they hated it. I mean, they hated it mm-hmm. with a vengeance, and absolutely junked it and destroyed all the copies. And so it was completely forgotten. And then absolutely by chance, about 2 years ago, I went to... It sounds like I'm so old. 2 years ago, I went to a 90th birthday party and of a friend, and there was one of the original producers. And I said to him, you know, whatever happened to that film? I never heard anything about it. And he told me the story about it being junked. And I said, well, have you got a copy? And he said, well, you know, because it's pre-digital age, of course. So he hadn't really kept a copy, but he had a very bad VHS. But, I mean, it was falling to bits. That was no use. And so I thought, oh, well, never mind. Put it all down to experience. And then the third coincidence, and this really was a miracle, I was trying to find a copy of another film of mine. And I know that quite a number of my films are in the British National Film Archive.
Mm-hmm.
So I went online and I was kind of scrolling through the endless dreary films that I had made. And suddenly there was the original film, which was called All This in World War II, which
right.
was a film I hadn't made. But somehow the National Archive had got hold of a copy of it, believing it to be mine. And so I begged the National Archive to let me have this copy out. And so I looked at it, and then I kind of instinctively realized why 20th Century Fox had taken against it. But again, as you quite rightly said in your introduction, the idea of using these wonderful, I mean, really wonderful cover versions, and I mean, there were 30 of them originally. I think I used about 24 of them in the new film. They were so good. I mean, Leo Sayer, sensational. Mm. David Essex, sensational. Even the Bee Gees. And I mean, I love the Bee Gees dearly. But I mean, they are, again, absolutely wonderful. And I thought, we can't let this material just disappear.
Yeah.
So we now had all this wonderful, I mean, really wonderful cover versions, which I'm sure the Beatles approved of. And then the basic idea of using Second World War material. But I thought, well, the subject is much richer than that. You know, we can expand it. We can talk about all kinds of other things and relate it to the present day.
Right.
And one of the nicest, before I stop, one of the nicest things that anybody said about the film, I mean, it's a completely new film. I've read one or two pieces where they say, oh, this is a revamp of the old film. It isn't a bit. I mean, the music's the same, but the whole thing is it's a completely new film. But one of the nicest things that somebody said, which I did take enormously to heart, was that this actually makes those great songs of the Beatles, Long and Winding Road, Yesterday, Fool on the Hill, and so on and so on, it makes them relevant today. And I thought, wow, I mean, that is the kind of accolade that I would hope for. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether McCartney's seen that, but... and unfortunately, John Lennon is no longer available to see it. But I mean, I'm sure that if Paul did read that, his heart would leap too. You know, to make the Beatles' music relevant to today. So okay, it's stuff from the Second World War. A lot of enormous number of amount of footage that I had that I'd collected over the years. But somehow you think, yes, that's about now. This film is about now. It's a completely new film about now. So I'm going on. You told me to shut up.
Well, I just want to make some comments on it, my own comments. You'll love them.
Yes, sure.
It's a different take. First of all, you've done a magnificent job on the quality of the video. The World War II newsreels and films are the best quality I've ever seen. You've done a great job with that. Now, the video, to me, would make a great teaching tool because we all timeline our lives to music. Why not do the same by learning history? You know,
Go on. Sorry, Ray.
My son-in-law is a high school history teacher who's very excited about the video. I mean, you know, putting music with history and the way it's presented, yeah. I mean, you know, it's perfect. It's every history teacher's dream, really.
That's very interesting because we had one big screening in England a week and a bit ago. I would think 50% of the audience, quite a big audience, came up to me and said, this should be in every single school in England. I mean, it was school in England. It was shown in England, of course. But in other words, the feeling was the same. This was, in the nicest possible way, an educational tool as to what happened in the Second World War. But I wouldn't want to say sugaring the pill, but, you know, using the music to demonstrate what happened. And I think another really important element in the film, which I hope you found as well, was to suddenly... I mean, my big hero at the end of the film is Roosevelt.
Yep.
I thought I really began to understand how important Roosevelt was in the organization of the Second World War. Of course, we're English, and we think, well, Churchill won the war. Now, Churchill made a very important contribution. But in fact, it was Roosevelt. It was his intelligence and his wisdom and his drive. And there are two wonderful moments in the film from Roosevelt's speeches. We've used quite a lot of Roosevelt's speeches, where he's announcing to the Congress how much they're going to have to spend. And he doesn't ask them. He just says, the amount we're going to spend this year on the war, and he looks down at his notes, of course he knew what it said, then look back up and with a smile says, $50 billion.
Yeah.
And that was end of discussion. Now, you can't
That's a lot of money
any
for
other
back
American
then.
President saying that. It's a wonderful thing. And then a little while later on, my favorite, and again, you realize what an extraordinary man Roosevelt was. Another wonderful thing he said is that after Mussolini, the dictator of Italy, had been captured, he says, and these were all his fireside chats, but they were filmed. He says, Mussolini came to the reluctant conclusion that the jig was up.
I like that. I remember that, yeah.
That's a wonderful thing for any politician, let alone the President of the United States. So he emerged, you know, as a real extraordinary man. And and of course Churchill is there, and Montgomery's there, and,
yeah,
and
Montgomery,
Eisenhower's
yeah.
there, and the,
yeah.
the rest are all there. But it's Roosevelt who's the hero, and so as I'm delighted that's your son-in-law's reaction, because that was the reaction in England. Should be in every school in
definitely.
England.
Oh, definitely.
This is what happened.
You know, I watched the video with my dad, who is a World War II vet. He was in Japan,
yeah.
in Okinawa, in Saipan. He's in his 90s. And, you know, I'm so glad he's still with us today. But he really loved the film as well.
Great. Well, I mean, it pays tribute to their enormous,
yep.
enormous sacrifices that people made and the enormous courage that they exhibited on all fronts. But in a strange kind of way, the music makes it relevant. I said, as I said before, makes it relevant to today.
Yep.
You realize that, yes, that is 60, 70 years ago. But actually, those people would have gone through exactly that today for the same cause. You know, it's not something that is, it's not ancient history. It's history as exemplified today. And of course, at the end, as you've seen, we bring it absolutely up to date with all the
exactly.
terrible goings on in Syria
yep.
and all of that. And you suddenly
yep.
realize, my God, nothing has changed.
Nothing's changed.
And again, I mean,
yep.
I never thought I would be pro Douglas MacArthur. I mean,
yeah.
if you'd asked me, I mean, I would have swallowed a whole bag of pills before I
yeah.
said I was pro Douglas. But actually, what MacArthur says at the end of the film,
mm-hmm.
you know, that the peace is now for keeps, and
yeah.
may God make it so.
Right.
And he says it with such eloquence and such a belief that you think, yeah, of course that's true. And then you realize that, of course, it isn't true. It's not his
yeah.
fault, but it wasn't true. Didn't
of course
happen.
And there was a disturbing scene, of course. I guess it was at Auschwitz with the you know, the Jews and all
yeah,
the bodies and you know, burying the skeletons and things like that, which
yeah.
you know, kids today need to see, because a lot of kids, you know, they're stuck on their iPhones, you know, and they're not, they have every tool possible at their disposal now to look up history. You know?
Well, I mean, I hope. I mean, the intention that when I made this new film, I mean, the intention was not to kind of shove history down your throat, but just to remind you of the sacrifices
exactly.
that people made, and
yep.
also of the terrible cost there was. I'm not
right.
talking about money, but in terms of, you know, people being killed and so on and so on. And also the bravery, I mean, the courage. I mean, there are two sequences in the film, which, I mean, I can't believe I edited them as the way I did. I mean, I'd want to say I'm really very proud of them, but I mean, that would be arrogant. But I mean, the attack on Pearl Harbor
right.
I Am the Walrus, I think is absolutely breathtaking.
Mm-hmm.
And the kamikazes attacking the fleet again. I mean, that's how the hell did those cameramen film that stuff? I mean,
I know.
They're right in the thick of it.
I know. I've never seen the
I mean,
footage
the bravery
like this before. You know, I really haven't. Now, and the way it was presented, I've never seen anything like it ever. It was
well,
amazing,
kind of.
An amazing job. You know, I'm giving it 5 stars. I don't care what anybody else says.
That's very sweet of you, because I really feel that you've absolutely understood what we were trying
oh, yeah.
to do. And I mean, forgive me for going back to something I said earlier. I mean, I'm just getting a bit pissed off with it's not happened very much, but one or two people have said, oh, this is just a revamp of the old film.
Which no, not at
seen.
All. Not at
well,
all.
Well, firstly, they haven't seen it, because it's
That's
not
right.
there to be seen. So
yeah.
what the hell are they talking about?
I hate critics, you know. If I have nothing good to say, I won't say it. you
yeah.
know, what's the point?
Well, it's their opinion, and I respect that. But, you know,
yeah.
they clearly can't have looked at it. That was what I felt. Anyway,
You know, I've chatted with a lot of legendary musicians who had very interesting World War II experiences. You know, I've talked to John
yeah.
K.S. Steppenwolf. He's an Iron Curtain
cool.
survivor. John Mayall. I think
yeah.
he remembers when, as a kid the Blitz, and also
yeah.
Petula Clark, you know,
of
who
course.
Was involved.
Of course.
So
of
that,
course.
That, maybe that's another movie, you know?
yeah, it could be. I mean, it could be. I mean, I feel very strongly that, as I said at the beginning, that the performances that we get, again, I had absolutely nothing to do with that, and the orchestrations that we get are with people, as I said, with people like David Essex and Leo Sayer and Rod Stewart and so on and so on, are just wonderful. I mean, they are absolutely wonderful. It's quite funny, at the end, as you know, at the end of the film, we go through who sang what so people don't get confused. And the pictures of them come up as they were in 1976. And the interesting thing is the only one, the only picture, the only picture of the person who looks exactly as he did in 1976, he looks exactly the same today, is Rod Stewart. Hasn't changed a bit. Because, I mean, some of them you'd have struggled to recognize, I think. David Essex you wouldn't recognize now.
You know, I was surprised how many artists did covers of the Beatles. I wasn't aware of a lot of the Leo Sayer stuff at all.
Yeah.
And he did a great job.
Those covers were done especially for the soundtrack. I mean, they were specially orchestrated and they were specially recorded. I had nothing to do with that. That was my big inheritance. And it was that, in a funny kind of way, that got me going. Because I thought, you know, these are just too good to have disappeared.
Exactly.
I know they're on a CD, but they're just too good to have disappeared. And in fact, as I think there were 30 tracks originally, and I think we used 24, or at least part of 24, possibly 25.
Well, it's an awesome film. I always said a good editor and a good, you know, engineer, that makes everything. If you don't have those two things, then, you know, forget about it, you know?
Well, it helps. It helps. And I think it's really, I thought it was really important when I began to think about what I could do with the material was to really literally start from scratch. I mean, I think the amount of archive footage that is in the new version of the film, or the new film, I should say, it's not a version, the new film, compared with what we took from the old film, it's about 10%. I mean, we only used about 10% of the Second World War archive that had been in the original film in the new film. I mean, so 90% of the archive is stuff that I found that I thought was relevant, and some of it, I mean, it's probably not for me to say, but I mean, some of it is absolutely breathtaking. Breathtaking. You can't believe that there were cameramen filming this stuff.
Exactly. And the way you added the old films, like Rommel, you know, James Mason.
Oh, yeah.
Did you do that, or was that already in the film?
There was a bit of it in the film, but, I mean, as I'd worked a lot with Richard Burton, I felt it was really important to get him in somewhere, so I wanted to include that.
I was actually friends with James Mason, James and Clarissa Mason. They were customers of mine, in D.C. So.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
James Mason made several appearances, once with a German accent and once without a German.
Yeah, he was a great actor. Great actor.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful actor. As was Richard, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, you work with Richard in a couple of movies, correct? There's a couple of movies.
Well, one big movie about Richard Wagner.
Right.
And I'm always asked, you know, what was it like to work with Richard Burton? I mean, it's a familiar question. And I say, well, it was fine, except for one thing. He was a bastard. Why was he a bastard? He stole the best secretary I ever had, who was his last wife. His last wife was my secretary, Sally, and she was without doubt the best secretary I ever had. Bastard, he stole her from me.
Was that during the filming, or was that before?
Yeah, it was during the filming.
It was during the filming. You did that movie, Wagner, and you also did In From the Coal, right, with Richard Burton?
That's right. That's a documentary. Well, after he died, Sally was absolutely besieged by people wanting to do the quote, official film about Richard Burton. And, of course, what she was worried about was, you know, that all they would say is, oh, that old Welsh drunk who threw his career away by making all those bad Hollywood movies. And she wanted to make sure that didn't happen, which is why we made the film we did. And, you know, I used to say, any actor who can do Spy Who Came In From the Cold, Equus, and so on and so on, he's a bad actor? He's a drunken Welsh actor through his career? Come on! You know, this is one of the greatest screen actors of the second half of the 20th century.
That's
Shut up, you lot.
I know. I don't know what people were thinking. I really don't.
Well, there was a very funny experience when we were doing In From the Cold, which I'll tell you very briefly. I wanted to interview Mike Nichols, because Mike Nichols had directed Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Right.
And so Mike said that he was filming, I think it was called Working Girls, on the Lower East Side, and would I come down to the set? And he'd find some time. So I said, fine. So I was very kind of him. So down I went, and he found some time, and we disappeared to an upstairs room. And the first assistant said to Mike, very pointedly in front of me, you've got 10 minutes. Well, 40 minutes later, Mike Nichols and I were still talking about Richard Burton for the film, right. For my film. And suddenly I spied out of my left eye, as it were. I thought the first assistant come up to, you know, to basically take Mike Nichols away, long outstayed his welcome. And obviously there was a big film crew downstairs waiting to go. And so I stopped the conversation. I said to Mike, I've got more than enough. What you said is absolutely priceless. And thank you very, very much. I'm really very grateful. And we stood up and shook hands. And then Mike turned to this person who was behind me and said, oh, Harrison, do come and say hello to Tony Palmer. And it was Harrison Ford. So we spent another 20 minutes with Harrison Ford telling me how much he admired Richard Burton and what he admired about Richard Burton. You know, great, great actors recognize each other.
They do.
Know those special qualities.
They do. You also did, which I found very interesting, The World of Peter Sellers. I think it was back in 71. Now, why was that? Was that banned by the BBC?
It was originally banned. Well, it's still banned by the BBC. Well, I think what the BBC... Peter Sellers was then at the height of his fame.
Right.
And I knew him quite well, even before I started to make the film. And I realized that he was, from a psychological point of view, an absolute mess. You know, haunted by all kinds of demons.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, as politely as I could to him, I think making a film about you would be very interesting. And he looked at me and he said, you know, I'm not going to just do silly jokes. And I said, no, Peter, come on. That's not the kind of film I would want to make.
Right.
And so the kind of film I made was not what the BBC was expecting. The BBC was expecting a film about a great comic.
Right.
And it's a name-dropping story, but I knew Stanley Kubrick, and Stanley Kubrick had told me one funny story after another about filming Peter Sellers later on. I mean, not when I made the film, but later on. Anyway, so we started to make the film, and one evening Peter rang me up and said, I've been invited to a party. Will you come with me? And I said, is it for the film? He said, no, nothing to do with the film. I just need someone there with me. How do you feel? Peter, of course, I'll be right round. So round I went. And we walked, in fact, from his apartment, which was in Mayfair, to where this party was. And I said, I'm very flattered that you asked me. You could have asked a lot of other people. But mm-hmm. He said, well, actually, I thought you're the one person who's going to get me through this particular party. And I said, well, what's the problem with it? He said, I know that when I arrive, somebody's going to come up to me and say, oh, you're Peter Sellers. You know, do us one of those funny things. Mm-hmm. And if that happens, you've got to either hit the other person or take me firmly by the hand and go. So I said, come on, Peter, you don't need me to protect you. So we arrived at the party. And we hadn't been there 5 minutes before somebody, some idiot, some yahoo, came up to me and said, oh, you're Peter, but what's it? Do us one of those funny things.
Oh, jeez.
So I didn't hit him, but I dragged Peter away, and we went off and sat in the corner. But he felt he had no persona himself.
Right, right.
He was all the characters that he had played and continued to play, of course, for the rest of his life and rest of his career.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted a film that was about a non-person, if you like. Mm. And, of course, it was much richer and much more complicated than that. But the BBC hated it because, and it was the reason I left the BBC,
right.
They hated it because, you know, it wasn't a film about a great comic. It was a film about someone who was in trouble and who was very complex and who, you know, was a great comic, but that was not what was interesting about him.
Hmm. I thought it was very interesting to know about his real side. You know, it's like
absolutely.
You know,
and I mean, to some extent, I mean, all the film. I would not want to say I was inspired by that film, but I mean, it was a big lesson for me because I realized that you know when you mentioned one or two of the other films that I've made, like Maria Callas and Margot Fonteyn. You know, I realized it wasn't enough to make just a film about. You know, you had to not dig the dirt up, but you had to try and understand these people.
Right.
Now, the Maria Callas film, for example, is a perfect example of what I mean. You know, this is one of the greatest opera singers of the second half of the 20th century. But my film is not a film about an opera singer. Oh, and by the way, she's a woman with problems. My film is a film about a woman with problems. Oh, and by the way, she's a great opera singer, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So it was really, I mean, I've tried in those kind of profile films all the time to try and understand what it is that these people, not what they've given to us, we know that, but the cost that they pay in order to give us what we appreciate.
You know, people, so, I think people...
It's tricky.
Yeah. People identify, to me, I think they identify more with when the real selves, they come out and they show their that they have problems and they're human just like everybody else, you know?
Absolutely. And it's not digging. I mean, I get, you know, we were talking about critics earlier. I mean, I get fed up with critics saying, oh, he's just digging the dirt. I'm not digging the dirt.
No,
I'm trying to understand another human being.
Right,
now, this other human being happens to be very famous, a great dancer, a great singer, a great whatever. That's, of course, really important. But in the end, I think it actually enhances and makes our understanding of these people richer. I mean, once you know that Maria Callas, we keep talking about her, but once we know Maria Callas was a woman with horrendous personal problems and yet was a great singer, when you now just listen to her voice, you think, fantastic, look what this woman achieved in spite of everything. That's really important.
It's like Robin Williams. Now that we found out the other side of him, you know, how could he be laughing and smiling and telling all those jokes when he had those issues in his life, you know?
Of course, interestingly enough, it was one of the subjects on my hit list.
Oh, really?
I thought, well, I really ought to have a go at Robin Williams, precisely that. And I know all the Monty Pythons very well, and I know Terry Gilliam, of course, and Terry Gilliam had worked with him. So I thought, and I discussed it with Terry Gilliam and said, well, there's only one way to find out. Just ask him. And but it was too late. Anyway.
Well, if you ever do something again with music, do something on Jimmy Dore of Robin Trower, and also do because he was very, very underrated, you know, and there's probably a lot of good things there. And there was somebody else I was going to mention.
The little thing I did with Hendrix, I mean, was again fascinating. I mean, you couldn't not admire the way he played. But actually, when you talked to him, you realize he was very shy, very diffident, very insecure, very uncertain about what he played. And I mean, that mixture of this fantastic performer on stage, who was also a bundle of nerves. Well, that came out in the little thing I did with him. But, I mean, it was it's the same sort of thing, really. You know, the real people, they're not. I did a film once about Bobby Moore, who was the English captain.
I was going to mention that. That was wonderful, by the way.
Well, that film, we interviewed all, it was made a few years ago, but we interviewed all the members of the World Cup team.
Right.
Who was obviously Bobby Moore was no longer alive, but we interviewed all the others. And Jack Charlton, who was this kind of monstrous, centre half, they were called then, you know, really held the team together. I went to talk to him in Newcastle, and we were just chatting away about this, that, and the other. And he suddenly stopped, and in the middle of a sentence, he looked out the window. And then he turned slowly back to me and he said, the thing about Bobby Moore, he said, was he was one of us, obviously a member of the team, but he wasn't like us. And I thought, that's a perfect description of genius. He was one of us, you know, did all the things that you and I do, but he wasn't like us.
Right.
There was something different about him. Yeah. That, of course, is a perfect description of great artists. They are like us, you know, they fart, they go to the lavatory, they eat, they have sex, but they're not like us.
Yeah, there's something special about them that we don't have, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, they go and we have to follow. I mean, they're out on their own charting new territory, and that's what's really extraordinary about them. And that takes courage, of course.
It does. Bobby Moore's story had Michael Caine, right, and David Beckham was in that?
That's absolutely right.
And they had it. It was a TV movie back in 2002. And
that's
it was,
brilliant.
Of course,
well done.
Yeah. It was about an English professional footballer, and it was a team that won the 66 World Cup in for England.
That's correct.
And he was part of that.
That was a fascinating journey, but I mean, I learned a huge amount about Bobby Moore. I mean, not just Jack Charlton's description, but I mean, again, about all the problems. I mean, when he held the World, it's also about courage. When he held the World Cup in his hand, the famous iconic photographs, what nobody knew except two people, Alf Ramsey, the manager, and his then wife, Tina, what nobody knew was that he'd been diagnosed with cancer and told not to play.
Right.
But he ignored them and went straight on. And when we made the film, I knew that when we made the film. Mm-hmm. And Alan Ball, another wonderful player who since died, sadly, I said to Alan Ball, you must have known. Surely you must have known. And he said, well, you know, when we were in the bath, you know, the collective bath, we could see these marks on his back.
Right.
And somebody said, you know, those are chemotherapy marks. And then somebody else said, oh, don't be silly. Of course they're not. So we suspected, but we didn't know. And if Bobby didn't want to tell us, we weren't going to ask him. But the fact is, he'd been diagnosed with cancer, told not to play. Mm-hmm. And he consulted Alf Ramsey. And apparently Alf Ramsey said, it's up to you. And Tina said, Tina told me that she'd prefer that he didn't play.
Yeah.
Bobby said, oh, well, that, I'm the captain. Of course I'm going to play.
Right.
Again, an amazing story, you know.
It's an amazing story. It really is. The guy I was thinking about to do a story on, Keith Emerson, because, you know, of course there's...
Oh, right. Oh, Keith Emerson, yeah. Emerson
left. We just lost from suicide, so...
Really?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I interviewed Keith. He was a very nice guy. We talked for an hour and a half. Yeah, and he killed himself, unfortunately. His hand was not working properly to play the keyboards, and they think that's one of the reasons why he did himself in. Now, here's the legend. Tony Palmer was studying moral sciences at Cambridge University in the 60s, right?
That's right.
And you got a call to attend a press conference for the Beatles.
That's correct.
Okay. They just had a number one single, and you didn't ask any questions to John Lennon. And John Lennon asked you, why didn't you ask me any questions? And then you told him about your background and what you're studying at Cambridge, and he got so interested that you took him for a tour of the college. And he wore a beard.
Take him round. And I first said no, but he said, why not? And I said, well, you'll be mobbed, and that's not my idea of fun. So he said, I'll come in disguise. How about if I come in disguise? He turned up in a very silly beard and a brown Macintosh and a very big fedora hat. And we both got the giggles. And so he took them off. And he was very happy. And then at the end of that afternoon, he said, he scribbled a telephone number on a bit of paper and said, you know, after the concert tonight, we get taken away very quickly and I won't have a chance to see you again. But he said, you know, call me when you come to London. Well, I said, I'm not coming to London. I'm staying here. I have a chance of being an academic. He said, well, you know, call me. So I did eventually go to London to work at the BBC. And I still had this bit of paper. But by that time, of course, the Beatles were intergalactically famous.
Right.
So I thought, he's never going to. But I thought, nothing ventured, nothing gained. So I dialed the number. And you could tell from the girl's voice on the other end that I was the 400th person that morning who'd rung up to say, John Lennon said to call. And I said, well, he really did say to call. And she said, well, all right, she said. So I put the phone down and I thought, I'm never going to hear another word. About 30 minutes later, a man called Derek Taylor, who was their PR man, their main PR man. Derek Taylor, who subsequently he and I became very, very good friends, rang me back and said, I've got a message for you from John. And, of course, I was racing through my head, who the hell are you? What the hell do you want? F off, or whatever. So I was very nervous, and I said, well, what's the message? He said, why has it taken you 2.5 years to ring up? He'd remembered. So then we had met for lunch again very soon. A lot of brown rice, his favorite lunch. And a lot of things flowed from that, in fact.
Yeah, he gave you some of his contacts, right, in the music industry, and that kind of helped him for making...
I mean, it's almost impossible to realize that then.
Yeah,
I mean, we're talking...
Right.
We're talking end of 66, beginning of 67.
Right.
That then nobody took, if I can call it pop music, I mean, by that, of course, I mean rock and roll and everything else, popular music seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just thought, oh, well, it's, you know, it's all that trivial, awful stuff. And there were a lot of, and John over the brown rice said, you know, there are a lot of great musicians mm-hmm. who simply either can't get onto the BBC or
right.
won't appear on the BBC. You remember the Dave Clark show, I'm sure.
Sure.
A lot of gyrating nubiles.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not against gyrating nubiles, but, you know, you don't want, as it were, somebody like Jimi Hendrix appearing in the distance beyond the gyrating nubiles.
Exactly.
It's insulting. It's insulting to them as musicians.
Right.
So John gave me this list and said, you know, so you should make a film with these people. Demonstrating what phenomenal musicians they are, but also what they stand for.
Yep.
And I said, fine. Well, I mean, one or two of them I knew. I mean, oddly enough, one of the people on the list was Pink Floyd, and I'd been at school with Roger Waters. So, I mean, I did have a contact there. Most of them I didn't know at all, except by reputation. So John said, I'll make the contacts. I'll tell them they've got to do it. You make the film. So I said, fine. And so we made a film called All My Loving. John gave me the title again. I'm quoting what other people say now. This is not me being boastful. But, I mean, it absolutely overnight changed what people thought pop music was like and what it was capable of and what its role was and how important it was. I mean, it literally changed overnight. Because of that film. John and I had a bet, actually, interestingly enough, where we were talking about, he'd seen the film, and we were talking about what the likely reaction was. And I said, well, my guess is that the popular papers, they'll absolutely love it, and the quality papers, they'll hate it. They'll just think it's just pretentious bullshit. And he looked at me and he said, you're quite wrong. It'll be the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, come on. He said, I'll bet you £5, which was a lot of money in those days,
right.
That this would be the case. So, you know, the reviews came out. He was absolutely right. The popular papers loathed it. Mm. They thought it was pretentious gobbledygook. But the quality papers wrote reams. I mean, page after page after page. I have to add on, I never got my £5 from Mr. Lennon.
Jeez.
But, I mean, he was spot on. I mean, because that's what he did. You know, people suddenly realized, not entirely because of me, but partly because of this film, that, you know, the rock and roll popular music had two things. It had musicians of phenomenal ability.
Right.
You know,
right.
When you think that this was Cream's first appearance on any television,
yep.
You know, and you think of Clapton and Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker, phenomenal. Hendrix, the same. Pink
right.
Floyd, same. These were the great, extraordinary guitarists, drummers, whatever, extraordinary musicians. That was the first thing that the film made absolutely plain. And the second thing was that they weren't kind of completely incoherent, mumbling drug addicts. They had
right,
they were very
exactly.
articulate. They had a lot of
exactly.
things to say.
Yep.
Now, of course, today we wouldn't think twice about that. But
mm-hmm.
when that film was first shown in 68, that was an absolute seismic shock. That these people could actually speak in coherent, joined-up sentences. That was unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, John Lennon called the film a monumental achievement, and thanked you for creating the series. Bing Crosby held its editing and deemed it a priceless archive. Pete Seeger said that its colossal emotional, intellectual, and history range is breathtaking. And there was a 5-disc DVD of the series that was released May of 2008.
That's right. The series came a bit later than the first film, but I mean, they're connected. I mean, they're absolutely connected.
Now,
I wrote to Pete. I actually wrote after Pete Seeger said that. He wrote that to me in a letter. I wrote back to say, I said, Pete, I love you dearly, but you're getting a bit carried away. He wrote back. He just crossed that. My reply, he crossed it out and wrote over it, bullshit.
I mean, you included all the genres. I mean, you had folk, ragtime, Tin Pan Alley, vaudeville, music hall,
that
musical theater.
The
I mean, everything was there. Country, swing, jazz, blues, R&B, and, of course, rock and roll. Did you intentionally leave out disco and punk, or was that just maybe the time?
Well, no. I mean, the punk was a bit of a disaster. I mean, I finished the editing around about the end of 1975, beginning of 76.
Right.
Which, of course, punk was just starting.
Just starting,
and
right.
I went back and I begged the distributor to give me more money to do another episode, episode 18, as it turned out to be, about punk. And, I mean, the guys who'd given me the money, they were archetypical, very nice, Jewish, mainstream entertainment professionals.
Right.
You know, the idea of them messing with something called punk. I mean, remember, punk was turned down by EMI for the same sort of reason and taken up by Richard Branson. But it was. I begged them for more money, but they simply wouldn't. And, of course, at that point, they hadn't sold the series, and, you know, they weren't sure that they'd get their investment back. I mean, they got their investment back, and how?
Yeah.
But that was the problem. I mean, if I'd been dealing with... If Richard Branson had paid for the whole thing, I mean, he'd have ordered me to do punk, but he didn't. But these were very nice three brothers called Delphon and the Grades. I mean, the famous Grade family. But they were Jewish immigrants at the turn of the 20th century who'd made good, and they were all members of the House of Lords. And they were the ultimate respectable Jewish mainstream businessmen who put on the royal show at the London Palladium. So the idea of them doing punk was, I think, a bridge too far, really. So that was all. It was bad timing, or unfortunate timing, not bad timing.
All You Need Is Love, it was a 17-part television documentary series, right?
It was, yes. That was not the original film. The original film was All My Loving, but All You Need Is Love flowed from that. Very, very funny story about the title. I mean, John again said, you know, use the title. I'll give you a perfect title. Call it All You Need Is Love. I said, oh, wait a second, I think I know that title from somewhere. Isn't there a song about that? He laughed. Anyway, when that DVD box set came out to which you referred, he said that the American distributor said, you've got to do a title check, you know, a title search,
right,
to prove that you're allowed to use that title.
Right.
And I protested and said, well, that's ridiculous because, you know, it's common parlance now, all you need. No, we insist. So we found two interesting things. Firstly, the Beatles themselves had never trademarked or copyrighted the title. So it was that sense, it was free. No,
that's
never
interesting.
Did. But two people had, and they were the problem. Or they looked as if they might be the problem. The first was a brothel in Amsterdam, which had copyrighted the time. And the second one was a manufacturer of risque lingerie in Hong Kong.
Oh,
so eventually I went back to the American distributor and I said, come on, you don't seriously think they're going to complain if we use the title? I don't think they were happy about it, but they reluctantly agreed.
Oh, geez. Who would ever thought that, you know? Never in a million years. What was John like? You know, I've talked to a lot of people that knew him. I've interviewed Julian. Yeah. Did he have that kind of sarcasm going most of the time?
To state the obvious, he was very, very bright, very intelligent.
Yep.
And I think he was slightly dismissive. Mm-hmm. And don't forget, he came out of the tradition where they were used to being interviewed by people who'd come up and ask about their sex life or about the new number one and, you know, what was going on in the whatever. They didn't come from a tradition, and this was not only common at the Beatles, but common with a lot of people. They didn't come from a tradition where people were prepared to treat them with respect, both as people and as musicians.
Right.
And funny enough, I think that was my way into them. That, I mean, I didn't care about all the other stuff. You know, what I did care about was about them as musicians, great composers, and also as people.
Sure.
So I think I got on that level, I got on extremely well with him because, you know, he was not very good at small talk because small talk was what he'd been brought up on, if you see what I mean.
Right.
But he was interested in, you know, having serious discussions about this, that, and the other. And I think with me, he found he could have those serious discussions, and that I wasn't going to write them down and sort of do a tell-all for the Daily Mirror later, if you see what I mean.
Sure.
And that, I mean, interestingly enough, I've got quite a number of letters from him, or postcards and other things, which, I mean, I've repeatedly refused ever to part with,
mm-hmm.
because they were private between
sure.
him and me. So, you know, although he died, what, 36 years ago now?
Yeah.
You know, I still respect the trust he had in me, and I think it was mutual trust. And I think to that extent, he and I got on pretty well, I think.
I think, you know, I do the same thing when I do interviews. You know, I've probably done about 500 interviews in the last 3-4 years, I guess. It's amazing, you know. But they you know, when you talk to them, not asking the same stupid questions that everybody else does, and you dig deeper, you know, and like you said, you find the human side.
Yeah, and they have a lot to say.
They have a lot to say. Exactly right.
They have a lot to say, and they have a lot to say about the world in which we live.
Exactly.
And that takes us back to the new film. I mean, that was what I felt really
yep.
important to make clear in the new film, that this is about us and the world that we have made, the world in which we live today. And, of course, I can do that by using the archive, but also I felt that the music was doing it for me. You know, I wasn't trying to force the music into some mm-hmm. kind of historical straitjacket. I was really trying to let the music live and breathe and really demonstrate to an audience that thinks they vaguely know the songs. But actually, those songs are really important. They're part of our culture, and they're part of the way we are.
Yes. I you know, I've never thought about the Fool on the Hill being Hitler until this movie.
Yeah, right. Well, there you go.
I mean, it fits perfectly.
And the long and winding road, you know, as they're tramping yep. through the Philippines and so on.
And Maxwell Silverhammer during the...
Maxwell Silverhammer, yeah.
Yep.
I mean, who would have believed? It's Frankie Valli, isn't it? Who would have thought?
Never.
But again,
never.
I think that works very well.
It was a great... And the version of Because I've never heard before as well, the artist that sang Because.
The version of what? Sorry, I missed that.
Yes. That was great. That was wonderful.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah. Who were some of the musicians or actors that, you know, inspired you at an early age?
Among the rock and rollers, if you see what I mean. I mean, undoubtedly the Beatles. I mean, I think I twigged very early on that,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not excluding Ringo and George, but Lennon and McCartney were something special. There was something
right.
really interesting musically. I'm not a musician, but there was something really interesting musically going along here. I remember trying to beat to, is it Paperback Writer? There's one where you try to beat Four in the Bar and you constantly get lost.
Yeah.
Because it isn't Four in the Bar. It's quite a complicated time signature.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I twigged very early on. I was through, oddly enough, Jimmy Page. Jimmy Page was the first real contact I had with rock and rollers. And in fact, I mean, I went on tour with Zeppelin and wrote a famous piece about them, which, I found absolutely extraordinary. I mean, it's extraordinary musicians
yeah.
and extraordinary people. And the very antithesis of what their image was, that's what mm-hmm. I found gripping.
Mm-hmm.
But through Jimmy, I met all kinds of other people, like Eric Clapton. And, I mean, I remember going... I think it's not the first ever Cream gig.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the Dome in Brighton, a town on the south coast of England, as you know. And I was just completely bowled over. And I thought, these guys, I mean, they weren't up to full speed on their improvisations, but they were improvising pretty amazingly. And, of course, I filmed a Cream farewell concert. And one of the amazing things, and I'd been to many, many concerts by the time I filmed that, but one of the amazing things it seemed to me was that, of course, there were antagonisms between the three of them. nowhere near as bad as we are often led to believe. But there were antagonisms.
Sure.
But they were mostly musical antagonisms. I mean,
yeah.
They used to get bored playing the same old bit. So Jack,
right.
for example, would
right.
invert the bass line
mm-hmm.
to see if the other two noticed. And, of course, the other two noticed immediately. And you know, they were sufficiently good musicians. They could deal with it. Ginger was the worst. I mean, Ginger would deliberately change the time signature.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going along four in a bar, it would suddenly become five in a bar, then three in a bar, then four in a bar, then two in a bar, then seven in a bar. He'd do it constantly just to see if the other two were awake, if you see what I mean. And of course they were, and of course they could deal with it, and that's why they were such wonderful, one of
yeah.
the reasons they were such wonderful musicians. But that was the cause of the antagonism between the three of them. They were trying to outplay the other two, but of course the other two, they were all equally great. So they couldn't be outplayed. But I think after my initial realization of how important, musically speaking, Lennon and McCartney were, I mean, it was Cream that finally made me realize that these were great, great musicians, as well as being extraordinary people. And, of course, from then on, it was Hendrix and then Zeppelin.
Mm-hmm. I had a blast interviewing Jack Bruce. It was the year he passed away. We were promoting
yeah.
his last album. Funny guy, and you know he were talking about Ginger Baker, how he just didn't have a sense of humor.
Yeah. Well, the thing he didn't like about Ginger, or what Ginger didn't like about Jack, was that Jack always turned the volume up on his bass.
Uh-huh.
And Ginger, they had a fight about it. I mean, I think fisticuffs. And Ginger said, you know, why do you always do this? And then Jack said, so I don't have to listen to you. And then Ginger said, that's because you're fucking deaf. And on it went from there.
That's
but,
funny.
I mean, there was enormous love between them. I mean, there really yeah. was. I mean, great admiration, mutual admiration.
Tony,
I mean,
what's
when
next?
They split up, I
Go
mean,
ahead.
I remember the reason they split up wasn't because they were, you know, they were fed up and exhausted. They were exhausted. They were knackered.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I think in 2.5 years, this is well documented by Mankell Harry Shapiro, they did something like 280 gigs.
Yeah.
280 gigs all over the world
yeah.
in 2.5 years. That's a phenomenal number.
I think a lot of those
they
guys were burnt
absolutely
out.
Absolutely knackered. In
yeah.
fact, in the Cream Farewell that evening in the Albert Hall, I said to Eric, why didn't you just take 6 months off? You know, go sit on a desert island or something and recover your stamina and your strength and then get back together again. But they didn't want to. I think they had enough. Also, they were having very bad time with Robert Stigwood.
Right, right.
Which is a big story, as I'm sure you know.
When John Mayall turned 80 years old, he celebrated here in Sarasota. I'm in Sarasota, Florida. So
yeah, yeah.
I covered the show. I hung out backstage with him, just me and John. You know, he actually sets up his own equipment. You know, the guy's 80-some years old now.
Yeah.
He's still touring like crazy.
Yeah.
He promotes his music before and after the show, signing autographs. And just an
yeah.
amazing, amazing guy.
Yeah.
He
is very, very extraordinary, John Mayall.
Yeah.
I quite agree.
And you know,
well, there we are.
Yep. He's definitely the godfather of the blues.
Oh, definitely. Oh, undoubtedly. And they would all say so. They will all go along with that, I'm
yeah.
sure.
Tony, what's next on the horizon for you after this wonderful project that you've done? That you know.
Thank you. Well, I'm actually writing a book.
Oh, great.
I've written a fair number of books already, but
yes, you have.
Never quite about rock and roll. This is not about rock and roll.
Okay.
This is if I say it's my memoirs, that's not quite true, but give me
right.
a clue. It's just about why. It's really about why these people do what they do,
mm-hmm.
and the cost that they pay, and the extent to which we. As I said, the extent to which we admire what they do without really understanding what they have to go through in order to give us the magic that they do.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, mm-hmm. I've dealt with quite a number of folks of that ilk, so I'll try and pull it together and put it in some coherent form.
When will that be done?
What?
When will that be finished?
Well, if you listen to the publisher, he'll deliver it by Christmas time.
Of course.
No, I have started. I know that my wife would divorce me if I don't do it. She's been banging on at me for quite a long time.
Right.
To put it down, because I have three very interested but smallish children, 14, 13, and nearly 11.
Oh, wow.
And I don't think they have a clue about what I've done in my life now that I'm a geriatric. So my wife's view is that, you know, you have a responsibility to write it all down, so at least they'll have a vague idea who you are and what you did. I said, well, good luck.
Yeah, you know, it's unfortunate. You know, my daughter's also a teacher. She's an English teacher, and she's really into music, and she was brought up with my music, of course. I was brought up in the 60s music. Of course, I love progressive rock. I'm a big prog rocker, you know, Pink Floyd, Tall, Yes, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, that kind of thing. But she's very disappointed with her classes that don't know anything about even her generation. Yeah. And she's 31 years old.
It's the case. I mean, it is horrifying the extent to which... Well, that again, takes us back to the Beatles in World War II. I mean, I didn't intend it as a history lesson, but I can quite see that it is in a strange kind of way. Because the music they vaguely heard of, kids today, teenagers today, sounds very patronizing. I don't wish it to sound to be patronizing. But they really don't have a clue as to what actually happened in the Second World War. And if this is a way that they can come to some understanding of what happened and some understanding of how relevant it is to today, then I think job well done.
Yep, and it should be in every history class across the world. I recommend
it. I hear what you say.
Recommend it highly.
I will speak to the distributor.
Okay, great. If I can help in any way, just let me know.
That's very, very kind of you.
Tony, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Not at all. It's been terrific fun. I'm sorry you had problems finding getting the right bit of the mountain to track me down on, but we did it eventually.
The main thing is we connected, and you're on a mountain in Switzerland, so it's amazing.
I am indeed.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Ray, it's wonderful to talk to you. Thank you very, very much, and thank you for your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. Purchase The Beatles in World War II, the best collection of Beatles covers in a film ever at www.gonzomultimedia.com or amazon.com. Visit Tony Palmer's official website at www.tonypalmer.org. Coming up next on The Ray Shasho Show, guitarist Doug Aldrich of The Dead Daisies. Very special thanks to the great Billy James of Glass Onion PR for arranging this interview, and to the amazing Doug and Don Newsom with BBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Please join me bi-weekly Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552 or email us at ray@publicityworksagency.com. And don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, or the second edition entitled Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to Be Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C., available now at Amazon.com. You'll live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com. Specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio, Station 1.